from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll chat with Western writer Larry Swayze about his new mystery.
I'll get a preview of an upcoming New Century String Quartet concert.
And I'll talk with the actor playing Tevye in the touring production of Fiddler on the Roof. Plus, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Author Larry Swayze is best known for his Josiah Wolf Texas Ranger series of books. However, westerns are not the only genre he's comfortable with. His latest book, The Devil's Bones, is a mystery thriller set in Indiana. Travis DiNicola spoke with Swayze to find out more.
Larry, welcome back to Art of the Matter. Always great to see you.
Thanks for having me back, Travis. I appreciate being here.
So, we got to know each other when your first Josiah Wolf Texas Ranger book came out, and you've been doing this Western series for a while, and now you've got a mystery. I'm just wondering, is science fiction next for you, or?
Funny you should say that.
I knew you would have something.
I've actually got a short story in an anthology this month. It's called Western Weird, and it's kind of my science fiction Wild Wild West short story.
Larry, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's I knew it couldn't be that far around the corner.
Yeah.
But seriously, so here we are. I mean, you've had this great series going with the Josiah Wolf series, and what do you have out now? Four.
Four just came out in October, and the next one comes out in August.
Okay, so the fifth's coming out in August. You've got a great series going on. What prompted you to want to switch gears and write a mystery?
Here's the interesting thing.
Okay.
I wrote the mystery before I started writing the Westerns.
Really?
Yeah.
True. Now, I know you've always been a mystery fan. I mean, I think we actually first met originally through the BoucherCon Mystery Writers Conference.
And absolutely.
I know you had submitted, work, to, but more nonfiction, wasn't it?
That you mystery. Yeah.
You'd always been writing? Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, this is your first mystery novel.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I wrote this, I actually created the main character, Jordan McManus, in a short story I wrote in 1993.
Okay.
So I've been living with this idea and this desire to publish a mystery novel for almost 20 years.
Wow. Well, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm really thrilled with it.
So, this the process, is it different for you? I mean, you're working with Josiah Wolf. You're working with an established character, so you've got that already, and you've got a pattern of stories. I felt like the writing style was different.
The voice is different.
The voice is very different.
I think the voice is different. Structurally, the storytelling is different because I used multiple points of views. I used time shifts. I go back and forth and into the past stay in the present, where the Josiah books are more linear.
Yeah, more sort of straightforward.
Yeah.
Beginning, middle,
point
and end,
A to point B, and
much more of an adventure.
Yes,
and this is really digging back in the past. And this is so much of the mystery of this book is what happened before, and it's set in a small Indiana town. Tell me about the town.
The town is a fictional town, probably central, mid, northern.
Mm-hmm.
Agricultural
tomatoes,
absolutely. So there's a cannery in the town.
Mm-hmm.
They make ketchup. They can tomatoes. That's the primary employer of this town. So, and around the town, obviously, are nothing but fields that have relied for years and years and years and years on migrant workers to come into town, pick the tomatoes, process the tomatoes, and then leave.
And move out. And when they're there, I mean, it's like the population doubles for a while, and then it goes back to being a very small town.
Right.
And so that's sort of the background for the story here. And the main character, you've got a very young police officer, And from the beginning, he is just surrounded by drama and doubt.
Well, you know, they say write what you know. So, Jordan, he is young, and he really never wanted to be anything other than a police officer, but he's kind of got a hard way to go because his father owned the tavern in the town, and he was maybe not such an up and up character, and his brother kind of breaks the law doing some recreational drug use, so he's got that conflict going on. He's got female problems, so and then he gets engaged in this mystery just by being in, kind of drawn in by the marshal of the town, because Jordan's a deputy. So
And it's really centered around, I mean, where it starts, without giving too much away, is the disappearance of a young boy who and he disappeared back in the 80s and was the son of one of the migrant workers,
right.
And the body was never discovered. No one knows what happened to him, and that's trying to figure that part out is what leads to everything else and the unraveling of some very tangled webs.
Very, very tangled webs. Yeah, a drought kind of descends over central Indiana in the summer, and a pond dries up and exposes some bones, and everybody in town thinks it's the boy that disappeared 19 years earlier,
sure.
Tito Cordova.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it is or not, is another question. But Hollister, the marshal, Jordan's boss, is convinced of it, and he is drawn out to the pond, and ultimately Hollister is shot, and Jordan becomes, because he was the only one there, he also becomes a suspect.
Right. The sheriff and Jordan do not get along by any
Absolutely
means.
Not.
And the sheriff immediately, you know, whether or not he's doing his duty or just being kind of a jerk, he
well, I created that character well.
You know, he takes Jordan's gun away, and he's in, and wants to confirm that it wasn't Jordan who maybe shot his own boss.
Yeah, well, the sheriff is Jordan's ex-girlfriend's current husband's uncle. Okay.
Okay. Thanks. I was trying to remember that. I kind of felt like I wanted one of those family charts, you know, as I was reading it at times.
Well, you know, small town, everybody kind of knows everybody, and everybody has a history with everybody, and that's one of the things that I really wanted to focus on when I was writing this story, and one of the things that I find intriguing about small towns and regional mysteries is that you get into the interconnectedness of everything,
and everything is definitely interconnected, which leads me to a question. I to talk some more, much more about the plot itself, but I'm really curious about your own research and process in putting this together, in terms of how you did this, what were the things that maybe you were reading about or talking to people about that intrigued you, that you were trying to incorporate. I mean, how did that go about for you, Larry?
I did a lot of reading. I went to high school, but before that, it was my own emotional journey with this subject, because I went to high school in Anderson at Highland High School. And that was back in the time when it was junior high and high school. And so the migrant kids would show up in the fall.
Okay.
And then the first frost, they would just disappear. And I always remember, I always noticed.
So something
that
you had experienced.
Yes, I'd experienced that, and I noticed that, and it kind of always stuck with me. And that was really kind of the seed that kept kind of, or the grit that kept kind of, you know, in the oyster, that kept kind of rubbing on me, that I wanted to explore what happened to those kids.
And so that was, I mean, that was something pretty common even back in the 60s, 70s, 80s.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah,
because, I've only lived in Indiana since the mid-90s myself. And so I wasn't actually sure, you know, I mean, that tradition of the migrant worker, you know, that had been along for so long.
Absolutely. And, you know, it started probably in the 30s and 40s here, easily, if not before. So it's a long-standing tradition. So there was my own emotional journey. And then I did a lot of reading, there's a book, Crossing Over, by Ruben Martinez, or With These Hands by Peter Rothenberg. With These Hands, it really focuses a lot about the migrant culture and, you know, how the food that we eat today makes it to our table, which is all things that, I'm interested in, but also things that fall into the category of this book. So it's not just a whodunit for me. It's almost a cultural exploration of a part of Indiana that I think gets ignored.
Well, I was wondering that, because that was the sense I really got out of the book as I was reading it, was it was a much is about this place and this culture and that sort of developed in this community as it is about the mystery itself.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes a good mystery novel, and sometimes a novel that goes beyond being a mystery, you know, goes beyond that, has to incorporate the cultural aspects of, the town or the area that it's sit in, and the, or the culture of, say, a lawyer, you know, if it's a like a John Grisham book, it takes you into different areas.
So this was something that was sparked by what you experienced when you were younger, but how about now? I mean, going back and doing more research, I mean, did you, was that,
you know,
a part
of it? The culture's changed a lot.
Sure, of course.
I mean, because, I mean, the immigration is different now than it was in the 70s. The Mexican culture is, more prevalent in everyday life in all of the cities where, you know, when I was a kid, the school that I went to was probably 98% white.
Sure.
You know, so if you were different, you stuck out.
Yeah, of course.
Where now multiculturalism is, much more prevalent.
Right, right. And yeah, and it's something that, and certainly the kids that grow up with it are a lot more accepting of it than the kids were back then.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that, certainly comes across in the novel too. I mean, there is, I mean, certainly that fear and that racism that is driving, you know, a lot of what happened in the past, or maybe what people suspected could have happened in the past.
Yeah, this is not a real rosy picture of of those events.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, I tried to hit it honestly and, directly and head on, without sensationalizing it, and without hiding the prejudice or shying away from it, because I think it's all part of that. I think in this book I really explored how hate and prejudice can propel decent people to do things that are against their nature and have a negative outcome.
So I've got to ask.
Okay.
Is there ever going to be a connection between Josiah and Jordan? Is there any sort of a family tree there that's ever going to be? No?
No, I don't.
Now that you foresee?
No, you know, this is a standalone.
It is? I was wondering if there were thoughts also of, you know, is it, you know, something you want to try to continue as a series, or this is a...
I really want this one to stand on,
okay,
on its own.
Yeah.
I think the experience of writing with Josiah Wolf's, the Wolf novels are, you know, that's going to be six novels. That's a big idea. It's going to be probably end up between 2600 pages all combined. You know, this was a very tight...
That alone has to affect the way that you go about writing the book. I mean, when you started the Josiah Wolf series, I mean, you were kind of thinking, I believe, that, you know, you wanted it to be a series, not just one, but, you know, so you're setting up this character in a way that it can continue on with further adventures, whereas approaching the Devil's Bones, you don't have to worry about making a character or a situation that can be repeated over and over. You can really focus on just that part of the story.
Right. Nobody. I talk about
and
these
both
characters.
Are great.
Yeah.
But
thank you.
But I'm sure, you know, but a very different process.
It is. With a standalone, nobody's sacred. I mean,
I mean,
seriously.
Yeah.
Whereas with the Josiah Wolf books,
there's some people you just can't knock off.
No. Well, you know, his name's on the cover.
Yeah.
So he's got to show up in the next book,
mm-hmm.
which creates, as a writer, creates its own challenges.
Mm-hmm.
Where with this, I, you know, pretty much, I had, it was open season.
Yeah.
On who survived and who was good and who was bad. Actually, you know, one of the characters, Spider, Jordan's brother.
Mm-hmm. Who's a real interesting character.
He's a real interesting character. And thanks to my wife, he continues to exist throughout the whole book, because at one point in an early draft, she read it and she's like, no, you can't kill Spider.
No, I you know what? I have to agree with your wife on that.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, good call on that one.
Yeah. Of course, we don't know if he makes it to the end, but yeah, you know, so.
So what's next for you, Larry? Again, we mentioned the Josiah Wolf one. The fifth one's coming out late summer. What else do you have in the works?
I'm finishing up number six right now, the Gila Wars, which will be out in May of 2013.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
After that, that deadline is April 1st, and I don't know what's going to happen after that.
But I bet that when you do, we'll have you back.
Cool.
Go over the book signings, because I know you've got some of those coming up, and I want to make sure people know about them.
Absolutely. I will be at the Barnes & Noble in Noblesville on March the 14th from 5 to 8 p.m., and then I will be in Fisher's at Mud Sox on Allisonville Road March the 17th from 1 to 4 p.m.
Travis DiNicola with author Larry Swayze. His latest book is The Mystery, The Devil's Bones. For more information, visit his website, LarryDSwayze.com, LarryDSWEAZY.com. So LarryDSwayze.com. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
The New Century String Quartet has invited some friends to join them for their March 19th concert at the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center. The concert is called Taking Flight, so it won't surprise you that the Icarus Jazz Ensemble, remember those wax wings, is part of the program. Sharon Gamble invited violist Susan Chen and violinist Dean Franca, who happen to be married, to tell us more. Dean, who plays in both ensembles, explains why playing jazz is like mountain climbing.
So among the things we're going to learn today is why jazz is like mountain climbing.
Oh, yes, I have said that. Jazz is like mountain climbing in that theoretically you could do it without any training. You could just attack the mountain, and if you were agile enough and coordinated enough and your eyesight was good enough and you weren't too sleepy that day, you could accomplish amazing things and get to significant altitudes. But if you wanted to get any farther, or you didn't want to have some unfortunate accident falling off the mountain, it would be nice to have some tools of the trade with you. And if you're a mountain climber, I don't know what those are, but they probably sound like pythons and things that start with CR that you fit over your feet and pickaxes and oxygen. I bet that would come in handy too. Take oxygen. But if you're a jazz player, it would be your toolkit of your understanding of jazz chords and how they're related to scales, jazz scales, and how many different kinds of scales can go with this chord and that chord. And it's just somehow reassuring to know some of that stuff.
And like mountain climbing, it strikes me that you could get a little ways into a jazz phrase, but to finish it, to get back down off the mountain, that those additional tools might be useful.
Yes, that's true. And like a mountain, and here's another way I think it's analogous to mountain climbing while we're on the subject, Sharon. To be a mountain climber, you have to have a certain amount of foolhardiness, or you have to be lacking in a certain amount of caution, I suppose.
I'm not afraid of heights, for one thing.
Oh, that's a good, yes. Can't be afraid of heights.
I would think.
You have to have no fear, right?
No fear, yeah.
And I think that's true, too, of people that improvise, whether it's in jazz or in classical or mm-hmm. Baroque or whatever style of music, pop, that you're improvising in, or bluegrass or anything. Or even if you're rapping, you're improvising and you just have to have a certain amount of, hey, let's give this a go and let it lead where it may, and we'll see whether it works or not.
Fearless.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Not that classical musicians are not fearless. And it strikes me that it's just such an interesting conversation. You two have been together how long? You met in graduate school?
Yes,
80,
we were at IU.
1980, 79 or 80, somewhere there. Yeah.
And you both have deep training in strings, and you've played together for a long time. And one of you plays jazz, and the other one doesn't.
Yeah, that's right.
And you're bringing the two art forms together in the next New Century String Quartet concert, because Icarus will be a guest artist, which probably has something to do with the theme you've chosen for the concert, which is?
It's NCSQ New Century String Quartet Takes Flight, sort of were kind of trying to fly on the wings of Icarus. And I guess there's a story about not getting too high because then the wings melt.
Or too close to the sun.
Too close to the sun.
Yeah, to the sun, right. Yeah.
You're right, which meant too high.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that was sort of a fun pun or whatever. And also Mitzi Westra, who's got this gorgeous voice. And one of the things that she's, the song that she sang with us has this little bit of a theme of a bird flying away.
Oh.
So it's, yeah. That song is, am I branching off our subject?
No, please
here?
Go. I want to also hear about Alexander Pratt, who wrote that song in somewhere in the 40s, we think. It's a lullaby, a cradle song.
Yeah, and it was to celebrate the birth of his first son, Boris, whom Dean actually worked under. Boris had become a famous conductor in Canada, so it's a whole Canadian family, and Alexander Bratt is this very famous Canadian, French-Canadian, is he kind of? Yeah. Well, from Montreal, and he was a violinist and also a big professor at the McGill University and conducted the McGill Chamber Orchestra, and he was a member of the Montreal Symphony. Was he concertmaster too at one point? I'm not quite sure.
I don't know, but he is well known as a Canadian composer, especially that generation.
Do you remember that he also played in a string quartet? He had a bit of a chamber music career?
I think so.
His son, Dennis.
I'm probably mixing the two.
He was a member of the well-known, in Canada at any rate, Orford String Quartet. Mm-hmm. And Dennis was a Starker student, Jano Starker, the cellist at IU. Back in the, I guess that would have been in the mid-70s. Mm-hmm.
So the father's the composer. I think he had some kind of accident prevented him from playing more as a violinist, so he turned more into composing. And so the first son is Boris, who became a conductor, which he wrote the cradle song for. And the second son, I believe, is Dennis, who is the cellist of the Orford Quartet, Canadian's probably top string quartet at their time. So it's a very musical family. I guess the mother was a cellist, and that's how Dennis became a cellist, I guess.
But, all strings all the time in this family. I approve.
Yes, you're the cellist in your family, right, Sharon?
I can't get the cats to pick up the instruments yet, but I'm working on it. So this cradle song, is it kind of romantic? Is it if people think of a typical lullaby, does it have the lush phrasing that we might expect?
Yes, this would be probably the, I wouldn't say the heavy, but the more
substantive,
romantic piece on this program, a little heavier set than the other French pieces that we're going to do by Francais Amiol. So this is, I would say, what would Bratt remind you of, Dean? Another well-known composer, it's hard to describe his style, isn't it? We'll just have to hear it.
Well, that's right. Gives incentive to come to the concert.
Yeah.
But so is the Francais piece as whimsical as Francais tends to be?
Yes, very charming and very light. And in fact, I think I was just looking at notes about, I guess he said about the first movement, it's a la burlesque, I guess. It wants to be burlesque-like. And then of the last movement, it must sound like chanteuse. Like, am I saying this right, the French word?
Oh, chanteuse.
Yeah, chanteuse. And it's French nightclub sounds, a lot of glissandos, of wide vibrato and things like that. So, it's very lighthearted and charming, I guess. And and also about the scherzo, no lagging and no deviation, rubati and things like that.
Yeah, so keep
just
it moving.
Keep it going. Yeah. And we have, of course, our brilliant bassoonist from the Icarus, Mark Ortwein, playing the bassoon part with us, and Peter from the Icarus also on the bass, Peter Hansen. And I was just talking to Mark about this piece last night, and he was saying how it's actually interesting because this piece was written for the French bassoon, which is slightly different than the German bassoon he has right now. So he says it's trickier fingering. It's some registers are just harder to manipulate. So he says it's it sounds brilliant to me. So I think it's a really nice piece to showcase a virtuosic bassoonist. So that's what I love about this piece.
And it's kind of unusual. It's bassoon and string quintet, which is not a combination you find very often. Are there challenges as string players playing, you're used to playing with your string playmates, and suddenly here's this bassoon thrown in the mix?
I think so. I think it's always challenging. Like if you're playing Mozart horn quartet or some Britten oboe piece for oboe and strings or something, because wind players, their brains are wired differently from string players. We can take our bow out and play, and if we run out of bow, we'll change bow. If we're playing down bow, we'll change bow and play up bow. And so we're oblivious sometimes to the amount of time in which a phrase has to transpire, where wind players have to be critically aware of that because they will expire if that phrase doesn't transpire in a certain somewhat short period of time. So there's that factor. Also, it's a temperature thing. When the temperature rises, string pitches tend to go down. This, we're talking about the physics of the instrument because the strings stretch, or with the humidity, for example. Whereas with wind instruments, as the temperature rises, the pitch tends to go down. No, up, goes up,
the
goes
direction.
The opposite direction. So that's another example, I guess, of a challenge that you have when you combine instruments of different mechanics into one ensemble. But it's a challenge we really look forward to. Mark is amazing. You know, actually just an hour ago I heard him play in rehearsal with the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra saxophone.
He's scary good because he can pick up any kind of wind instrument and be brilliant on it. It's like, boy, that's freakish.
Yes, he played saxophone.
In a great way, but freakish.
Yeah. Yes, he played saxophone. It was a beautifully played solo in the Rachmaninoff Symphonic Dances this morning. That'll be at the end of this week. Performances on Friday and Saturday evening at the Circle Theater. So you could hear Mark there, but if you'd come last night to an Icarus concert, you would have heard Mark play bassoon. You would have heard him play electric bassoon. You would have also heard him play tenor sax and also bass clarinet, all on the same program. He's just, I've never seen anything like
it.
Brilliant,
yes.
Wow. Hey, speaking of crossover, you have a Gary Walters piece on this concert that was written for you, I'm guessing?
It's a string trio and piano trio, but I guess with the keyboard and percussion and string bass. So it's those three and the violin, viola, cello trio. So trio plus trio and three movements. And
of course, it had to be three.
Yeah. So actually on his original note in his computer, it's 3x3x3. So it's very interesting. And he, I have some notes about how that came about. I guess he had a electric piano that he owned, way back when. The same model he had purchased from Vonna Knapp, a warm soul, a member of the Butler University School of Music. So I guess Gary had the same model, which is an older keyboard, which he had sold to get, the latest
technology.
Yeah, you know, model for but had missed the sound of that older model. So he had purchased one from Vonna in 2000, well, I guess a while ago, because he missed it so much, the original model. So then he, this piece came about. So it's also, kind of a nostalgic, I guess.
Sure.
Yeah. And, that's one thing about chamber music, which I just love so much, because in chamber music, you can do so many intimate things. For example, this Miele Quartet we're going to play later on the program is also written, I'm not sure this one particular is written for a specific specific person, but a lot of his quartets are written for celebrating his wife's birthday, whatnot, and, you know, and in memory of his good friends who died in the war. And so, you know, Gary's piece, of course, is written, you know, with a gratefulness to Juana's keyboard, of course. And, you know, the pieces that we're doing, just when you do symphonic work, not that they're not written for people or intimate relationships, but in chamber music, it's just so immediate and
and you can hear
personal.
You can hear the individual voices so much more clearly.
And it's kind of a feeling that's in a very intimate form. And I don't know, it's hard to describe, but you know, when you do pieces, oh, it's written for so-and-so or written for this quartet, so-and-so player. And it's just, I don't know, it's just fantastic that we have these intimate musical relationships. But anyway, so
and
I'm branching off
and
again.
They grow deeper. And New Century String Quartet's been together for how many years now?
This would be our 11th?
12th.
Yeah, 11th. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Icarus has been playing together for, five years?
Yes, 5 years, although we've actually been playing together in various combinations for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Hansen, for example, the bass player, fine bass player and composer, lived just a few houses up from us, and we watched his son grow up, and now he's graduated from college, and Peter and I used to get together and jam, you know, so when the kids were just babies, and Peter and Gary go back a long way, and Gary and John go back a long way. And Mark is we kind of kid him because he's the baby in the group. you know, he has two grown teenagers himself. But we've been working together for a long time. Just at a certain point, it was mostly Peter and Gary said, wait a minute, why are we all these working separately? Why don't we just combine it all into one ensemble? And that's sort of how it happened.
It's a whole nother family.
Yeah, and you know, it wouldn't be as easy as you think, you know, being a couple playing together. I mean, I remember when we were at, you know, Juilliard coaching under Robert Mann, and he was like, oh, interesting. You know, how do you, you know, do it, manage? And I said, well, it's a matter of priority because, you know, invariably, you're going to have different musical concepts and whatever, and you're going to argue, and you're going to, you know, sometimes bring things that are not music related into rehearsals.
That never
you know,
happens.
And I mean, you have to just really separate the personal, you know, whatever in the house, you know, whatever disagreement about how to raise your child, for example, you know,
or
into rehearsals.
Or who emptied the cat litter the last time.
Right.
Yeah.
Things like that. And so it's, you know, I admire, you know, quartets or, you know, chamber groups that are, you know, have couples or family members together, like the Scott Chamber Players. I mean, it's just, it's wonderful when it works, but you do have to work very hard because... they're just, you know, like the Guarneri Quartet, they never, or Juilliard, they don't like to travel together. They don't like to stay in the same hotel. You know, they want a little bit of privacy, you know, and distance from each other. And so being in the same household, sometimes it's not as easy as it seems.
Well, that's why you're letting him climb the mountain while you stay down.
Sharon Gamble with violist Susan Chan and violinist Dean Franca. They're joined by violinist Louise Alexander, cellist Dennis McCafferty, bassist Peter Hansen, percussionist John Crable, keyboardist Gary Walters, wind player Mark Ortwein, and mezzo-soprano Mitzi Westra for Taking Flight, a concert on Monday, March 19th. It's free and at 7:30 at the DeHaan Fine Arts Center at the University of Indianapolis. To learn more, visit NCSQ, that's for New Century String Quartet, .wordpress.com. Again, NCSQ.wordpress.com.
Travis,
yes,
I
Sharon.
Know you have a little bit of a cold right now, so you're going to be really good at impersonating a lion. Can you do your best lion roar for me?
Wow, a stuffed up lion. Is that what this is? For coming into March?
Exactly,
is that the
right.
plan, Sharon? Okay, here we go.
Oh, I love it.
love that. Well done.
Yeah. I'm not even going to try the lamb right
now. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Later. You'll be well. You'll be well by the end of the month. You'll be well long before the end
of
the month. Hey, that's your cue, dear listeners, that yes, it's time for that wacky arts calendar we call
What'll We Do
for the first weekend of March.
Speaking of wacky, Matt Soucy.
Say no more. Put the period right there.
No, Matt Soucy, our resident film sociology host and blues house party, of course, and sometimes contributor to Art of the Matter. Well, he is directing Rumors, and this is taking place at the Scottish Rite downtown on Meridian Street at their Performing Arts Center, which is a great, beautiful space. And it is the Neil Simon comedy Rumors, and it opens on March 9th and is going to be running through March 17th. And includes evening and matinee performances, and it is a very, very funny show, and Matt is directing. And also they are having the Double Eagle Cafe open for dinner on the performances on March 10th and 7th, so you can have dinner beforehand, then go see the show. Very, very cool, definitely worth checking out. For tickets, call 262-3100 for Rumors.
And do make a point of checking out the cafe. That's very nice. Do you ever go over there for lunch?
Yeah, I have been there. Yeah,
it's very
great
nice.
Great little place.
Cool. Hey, don't be disappointed. I know a lot of our listeners tried to get tickets to go on daily tours for the Miller House in Columbus, Indiana. Tickets just went on sale this week on March 1st. So get online. Just Google Miller House Tour Tickets. Or you can call 866-811-4111. Once again, 866-811-4111. If you have any interest whatsoever in mid-century modern, and even if you don't know what mid-century modern is, you have to check out the Miller House. What an astonishing...
Just think Mad Men, right?
Yeah, think Mad Men. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But
stylish,
architecture.
Cool. And make sure you check out the landscape around the house as well.
Very cool. Hey, a lot of great stuff going on at Butler University and at Clues coming up over the next weekend. And next on Sunday at 3 p.m., the Butler University Jazz Invitational is taking place. And this should just be a ton of fun. And it is actually a free concert, so definitely worth checking out. There'll be lots of great high school jazz ensembles sharing the stage with the Butler University Jazz Ensemble. That's this Sunday at 3 p.m. And then next weekend, Sharon, is the Opera Goes to the Movies. We've both talked about this a little bit.
I love that, and we did a nice interview about that, too.
Yeah, very, very cool stuff. And it's the opera looking at opera music in movies from Moonstruck to Apocalypse Now, and there'll be great performances, and it's going to be a very fun show, I think.
Next weekend is a really big weekend. Don't forget the Indianapolis Art and Antiques Show at the State Fairgrounds benefiting Methodist Task Corps. And if you enjoyed my conversation with Carlton Varney, what a character. Remember, he cracked me up when he said that he asks all prospective employees to see their handwriting. He wants to see that, and he doesn't care if they don't have a beautiful hand. He just wants to make sure they can still write in cursive writing. What an interesting take on the world. And he is...
I'm not sure I would do so well with that.
You'd be fine. But he's doing that luncheon at the end of this coming week, so you can find out more about that online.
Very good. Hey, I also want to mention one other thing going on at Clues, and that is the Shen Yun Performing Arts Group. This is the traditional Chinese performances with a sort of contemporary twist. It's actually a group out of New York bringing together sort of classical Chinese music and dance with kind of a Western theatrical sense. It's supposed to be just spectacular. I've heard great things about it. Looking forward to that. And that is taking place starting on Tuesday, March 13th.
I have an event that's being put on Saturday night. That's this Saturday night by a group that has one of your favorite names for groups. It's Crème de la Femme. That's the burlesque company.
Yes.
They're doing this,
ooh la la.
Ooh la la. They're doing the second annual Rivoli Review at the Athenaeum this Saturday night at 7 o'clock. And as the name might suggest to you, it's a benefit for the Rivoli Theater. And in addition to having the lovely burlesque ladies of Crème de la Femme, it features members of the Indianapolis Philharmonic, musical duo Pat
Patchwork, the Bennu Dancers Belly Dancers, South 6-5 Band, singers Krista Gordon and Amanda Capps, and dancer Muriel Greenlee. You can find out more information about all of that, as well as about the great Rivoli Theater and see why it needs to be restored, at rivolitheater.org. And that's Rivoli, just like it sounds, theater, theatre.org. Rivoli Review, this Saturday night, 7 o'clock at the Athenaeum.
Very good. Hey, there's some great theater going on in town, of course, as always it seems, but especially right now, very excited about a couple different shows that are going on at the IRT. The comedy God of Carnage has just opened, and that is running through March 24th. Also, one of my favorite playwrights, Noel Coward, Fallen Angels, is going to open at the IRT on March 13th. Can't wait for that. And you absolutely have to check out, before it closes on March 11th, August, Osage County by Tracy Letts at the Phoenix Theater. Everybody I know who's seen it just thinks it is a fabulous production, absolutely amazing show, and very thought-provoking, and great theater worth checking out at the Phoenix. So both some great theater at the IRT and the Phoenix coming up this weekend.
You could punch your theater card several times over in the next couple of weeks and see some great plays. I have a couple things going on at the Indiana State Museum that you won't want to miss. One is Represent, which is a celebration of Indiana's African-American artists. That exhibit goes through July 15th. And there is some programming associated with that. And also not to be missed, while you're there, just make a day of it and check out Chaos is a Friend of Mine, Cultural Icons from the Jim Irsay Collection.
That's still open.
Check out all those great guitars and the original manuscript of On the Road. Oh, and by the way, some NFL memorabilia as well, as you might imagine.
So.
That's up until May 6th, so you can check that out. And as I say, get two great exhibitions in on the same day. IndianaMuseum.org is where to get more about that.
Something really cool that the Symphony does is their annual side-by-side concert, and that features 55 of Indiana's finest high school musicians performing next to their professional counterparts in the orchestra. And that show is coming up on Wednesday, March 7th at 7:30 at the Hilbert Circle Theater. A very, very cool concert. Again, the 21st year that they've done the side-by-side concert. You'll hear some great music, Sibelius and Block and all sorts of other great pieces that will be performed. Definitely worth coming out and supporting those great young musicians with some great professional musicians.
You, if you are listening to us on Friday night, you might be coming home from any number of First Friday exhibits. You might be coming home from the Stutz Art Space exhibit called Market. This is a group show examining marketing messages and how they engage us as art. And the circle of artists is unusual in that includes some people whose work you don't get to see all the time, like Kara Jean Wallers and Jack Wicks.
Oh, cool.
And many more as well. So if you if you're in your car, you might be able to get there before 9 o'clock on Friday night. And if you're thinking, I can't do that, it's open Monday through Friday from 11 to 2, or by appointment through March 30th. And I'll give you a little secret. If you work at such a place where you can pop over at lunchtime, it's generally not crowded and you can have plenty of time to just sit, stand, and enjoy the work and absorb the work.
There you go.
Yep.
Hey, last thing, Sharon, before we go, just give people a heads up. Diva Fest is coming back at the Fringe, celebration of women playwrights, 3 years and 6 plays, and that will start on the weekend of March 16th, and then going through the end of March. We'll talk more about that next week, as well as some great other things on that calendar that we call... Oh, you got one more
I
thing, don't you, Sharon?
I got one last thing. A congratulations to the Indiana Poetry Out Loud State Champ, who is Jordan Mather Licht. This event, you heard my interview with Zach Brooker, last year's state champ, a few months ago. I got to be a judge this year. Poetry recitation is alive and well in Indiana, so keep an eye on this young man, Jordan Mather Licht, and we'll tell you about other great things to do, maybe without the lion roar, next week on
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Without our traditions, our lives would be as shaky as A Fiddler on the Roof, announces Tevye at the beginning of this classic musical. Well, here's a tradition for you. Actor John Preece is now in his 10th national tour of Fiddler on the Roof and has performed in the show more than 3,500 times, with more than 1,800 of those performances as Tevye. Travis DiNicola spoke with Preece by phone to learn more about the touring production coming to town next week.
So when you do, you know, 8 shows a week for 40 weeks, do that for 4 years, that really pushes the numbers up. But yes, I've been doing it pretty solidly for 20 years, and I think it's about 3,400 times of the show.
Wow. You know, so some people obviously, you know, get used to being actors who, play Santa Claus. You're obviously who people think of now when they think of Tevye. I know you have your own beard that you keep and keep that long just for this, but what keeps you coming back to this role? I mean, 10 tours now, to keep saying yes to coming back to that.
Well, it's a great show. I mean, it's incredibly well written, and even some of the smaller parts in the show are wonderful, fun to play. But Tevye itself, that role is probably one of the best written roles in musical theater, and I think that that combined with the music and with the other roles that you deal with in the show, it keeps you going. You know, you may think it gets stale after a while, but it really doesn't. Once that fiddler starts playing and the music begins and you walk out there with that audience, you're fully committed to the script and to keeping it honest and to playing it. And it takes a lot of energy, but it also at the same time requires you to be honest and on top of your game
each and every night. And it is a great show. It's one of my favorites. I have always enjoyed seeing it. I'm looking forward to this touring production. But let me ask you, you actually wanted to play Tevye long before you were kind of ready for it, correct?
Yes.
So, I mean,
I started doing Fiddler back when I was working my master's in Southern Illinois University. That was the first time I was introduced to the show. And then I saw some productions of it over the years, and it became something I really wanted to do. And then I got the opportunity to do Laser Wolf at a regional theater and understudy Tevye. And then, of course, I went on as Tevye several times. I was a little young for the role, but again, I'm a character actor, and I'm not really the handsome leading man type. So, it fits in, it works together. So it was something I've wanted to do, and then I got the opportunity to do it. And then about 22 years ago, I had the opportunity to go and audition for Sammy Dallas Bayes, the director up in New York. And I've been pretty much working solidly ever since.
So what makes this particular production a special one? You've had the opportunity to work with many different casts with Fiddler on the Roof over the years, many different productions. This is your 10th tour. What makes this one special for you?
Well, as I said, I've been working with Sammy Dallas Bayes, who was in the original company with Zero Mostel and Jerome Robbins when he put the show together. And this is a very good company. I mean, it's a good cast, a strong cast. All of our major roles are pretty much age appropriate and good actors, good solid actors. But Sammy, the one thing about this show which I always enjoyed is the fact that this is all based on Jerome Robbins' original concept. This is the original choreography that he put together, and of course when he put that together, there is a reason for every move, and you get to learn those over the years, you know, and you know what the significance of every nuance is. So the fact is that this is based on the original production. It is costumes, sets, staging, all of that is very close to what was originally designed.
Excellent. And so as you're doing this each and every night, and I know that, I mean, just the quality of the show is what makes it exciting, but are there certain moments, certain numbers that you really look forward to that sort of keep you energized to be able to tackle each and every night?
Well, yes. I mean, of course, Rich Man is probably one of the best known numbers in the show, and it's a long number, but it's quite fun to do. And then there's some very nice moments, Sunrise, Sunset, and Sabbath Prayer. But I guess my favorite is in the second act when I sing a song called Little Bird, Little Havala, where they do the Havala Ballet, where after he has said no to his daughter, turned his daughter away from the family, he stops and reminisces and remembers her and sings his song to her, and it's a beautiful moment.
Ever any moments when you think, oh, not this number again? I mean, I've seen Frumacera too many times, or
no.
No.
Of course not.
No, it sounds like it's certainly a role that you enjoy, but you've also had, I mean, many other great roles as well. I know that you've had the opportunity to play Ben Franklin in 1776, as well as The Devil in Damn Yankees, and also Quixote in Man of La Mancha.
Correct.
I can almost sort of see how those roles are connected.
Well, they are. You know, I'm not a skinny, tall Don Quixote, but I can certainly perform it and sing it and know it very well. So, mm-hmm. I would say that fits me pretty well, that role.
Have you had a chance to perform in Indianapolis before?
I have. I was there with, I don't know if I've done Tevye there.
Mm-hmm.
I did Lazy Wolf there several times with Theodore Bickel.
Mm-hmm.
When we were on tour with him over the past 20 years. But I don't remember whether or not I've done Tevye there or not myself.
Anything special you would recommend for audiences here in Indianapolis, maybe those who have not seen the show before, seen it for the first time, to really pay attention to in this production?
Well, that's kind of our job, to make it all totally understood to them, so mm-hmm. they don't have to think too much, but the fact of the matter is that this is a great family show.
Travis DiNicola with actor John Preece, who plays Tevye in the touring production of Fiddler on the Roof, which plays at the Old National Center downtown from March 6th through the 11th. Ticket information is available at indianapolis.broadway.com. Again, indianapolis.broadway.com. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4, when I'll meet some Heron art students who are going to be exhibiting their work here at WFYI.
I'll get a preview of the upcoming Indiana Artisan Show.
And I'll find out about a unique collaboration involving artists and couches.
Is there beer?
Well, there will be our arts counter, we call. What do we do?
So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.